You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the pandemic caused Wisconsin nonprofit groups in several sectors to rethink the way they operate. A Wisconsin reporter tells us why some of those changes may stick around. Now, about 44% of households in the U.S. have a gun in the home, according to polling from Gallup. So if your household is one of them, how can you make sure your gun is stored safely? And what should gun safety conversations with your kids sound like? Those are questions our next guests have been thinking about. They say we can set aside some divisive conversations around gun policy in the U.S. and take practical steps to keep guns out of reach for kids. Dr. Emily Ray is a child and adolescent psychiatrist with Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Dr. Ray, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Greg Head is a child and adolescent therapist also with Gunderson Health System. Greg, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. We at Gunderson want to thank you for highlighting this issue.
Dr. Ray, can you tell us a little more about why you wanted to start talking about the issue of gun safety for kids?
Well, there are several reasons. I mean, in my job, I work with adolescents on an inpatient behavioral health unit. And so one of our big focuses is preventing suicide. And then, of course, the other reason is just the headlines that, you know, occasionally, unfortunately, we hear about school shootings. So these are issues that really touch on all of us, and I think it's an important message to talk about gun safety.
And Greg, the pandemic has been really hard on youth mental health. There were concerns about youth mental health even before the pandemic started. Can you talk about why that's an important part of this conversation?
Well, really, just a lot of unexpected things have been occurring, and we're seeing behaviors from teenagers that we really had never seen before. We have some early preliminary research that talks about their isolation and a lot of the stress from schooling and just the ongoing nature of the managing the pandemic. But we are seeing things that we've never seen before, which makes us as child safety professionals think about being even more vigilant and being safe, especially with firearms.
Dr. Ray, as parents, I don't know, can we make wrong assumptions about how our kids will act when we have guns in the house?
I think that we probably, there is danger of that. I think that we might assume that since kids took a hunter safety course that they'll know, not to touch that gun. I think we might assume it with our teenagers because most of the time they seem very stable, that they're never going to have a bad day and make an impulsive choice with a gun. So I think we need to be vigilant always when we have a gun in our house.
Greg, I understand you're a gun owner yourself. What are some of the basic safety tips you would hope, especially parents, keep in mind with a gun in the house?
Well, as the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends, obviously the best, most safe way to protect a child from being involved in accidental shooting is to not keep one's firearms in the same location where a child resides, and for them to avoid visiting a home where a firearm is located. However, if storing your sporting arms is in another location is not viable, there are lots of options available nowadays for securing firearms, Rob.
Yeah, what are some of those things people could do, assuming that they want to keep the firearm in their house? What are some of the more accessible precautions they can take?
Well, first off, firearms should always be unloaded when not in use, and they should always be stored unloaded. Ammunition should be stored in a locked location separate from your firearms. One of the most readily available and affordable gun locks happens to be one of the most effective, and that's the cable lock, which ranges in price from $10 to $50 and is often based, it's often even available free of charge at certain community service agencies. But this is a very effective way of securing firearms. The cable runs through the barrel or action of the firearm to prevent it from being accidentally fired, and it requires a key or a combination to unlock it. And if one secures that key or that combination, it is a relatively safe way of keeping your firearm stored safely.
Dr. Ray, if there's a child in the home who's being careless around firearms, what would you want to hear from a parent? What kind of things can they do to intervene?
Well, I think if there's a child that's being careless around firearms, I think that the child, you just need to make sure that child has absolutely no access to firearms. And if, say, your child was out with you hunting and they were being careless, I think most parents would say, okay, I'm sorry, you're not going to be able to get to use this again, you know, for a period of time until I know you can be safe with it.
Greg, let's talk about guns. When should parents start talking to kids about gun safety if there's a gun around in particular? What kind of conversations do you want to see happen?
Rob, I'm so glad you asked that, because really these conversations need to start fairly early on. Whether you choose to have guns in your home or not, please be sure to talk to your kids about guns. Children need to know that guns are very dangerous. Teach your children to follow certain rules if they see a gun. For example, children should stop what they are doing immediately if they were to see a gun. Children should never touch a gun or allow anyone else to touch a gun, even if it looks like a toy, and emphasize that, even if it looks like a toy. They should then immediately leave the area where the gun is, and please, after that, tell a trusted adult right away.
Dr. Ray, let's go to the teenagers now. You mentioned earlier, how does their cognitive development impact their decision-making when it comes to firearms?
Well, we know that our brains are developing, you know, even into our 20s, and especially in teenagers, their frontal lobes aren't as developed as somebody who's, you know, in their 30s. So part of what that means is that they're going to be more impulsive and they're going to be more in the moment. So I think it's even, you know, more critical when you have a teenager around to keep the guns stored safely.
Greg, are you hoping to start a conversation around these issues, especially again for those parents?
Absolutely, because every responsible firearm owner that I know is just as concerned about this as every other parent. And so if we can get beyond some of the politics and talk about the fact that we have guns in our community, how do we keep our children safe? I think that is the most important thing.
And Dr. Ray, as we wrap up, for that parent who might find themselves concerned that their child of whatever age might seek to harm themselves, what recommendations can you leave us with?
Well, I think certainly if you have concerns for your child that they may harm themselves, you can either go directly to an emergency room, you can call your child's pediatrician or primary care provider, you can call the National Suicide Hotline. There's many avenues, but I think just don't ignore it. Take it seriously.
Thanks for joining us, Dr. Ray.
Thank you.
And Greg, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Dr. Emily Ray and Greg Head. They both work in child and adolescent psychiatry at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. They're with us today to talk about how to practice household gun safety and how to start a conversation about issues related to gun safety with your kids. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about a woman setting the record straight on history.
Joyce Alter Johnson has loved history her entire life, but as a descendant of slaves, her family history, like the history of many Black families across the country, was largely struck from the historical record. Johnson had to take it upon herself to uncover her family's roots. WPR's Christine Hatfield brings you her story.
Who we are is determined by where we come from, our parents, where they come from, their parents, where their parents come from, and a chain of unbreakable links that could explain not only our genetic makeup, but also our personalities.
Joyce Salter Johnson's love of history started with a missing link in her family's history. She says her grandmother appeared to have no roots at all. She essentially lived alone in a nice house in the South that her grandfather sent money home to build while he worked on the Illinois Central Railroad. Johnson has always been a storyteller, and the holes in her family's history left room for her curiosity to thrive. When she reached adulthood, that curiosity transformed from fantasy into research. It took years to get answers to her family's story.
Before 1866, there was nothing written in any archive about slaves. Nothing. The information that you needed from to find out about the enslaved person was in the archives or the databases or the journals of the people that held them enslaved.
Eventually, she traced the Salters back to 1792, when Hardy Salter was born to enslaved parents in Virginia. The journey of the Salters took them to Good Hope, Mississippi. That's where Joyce Salter Johnson grew up. Over the years, life led Johnson to Freeport, Illinois, and eventually Madison, where she's lived for more than 30 years. But it was Freeport's Historical Society that inspired Joyce's next historical endeavor.
So for years, we would always get these really nice publications about Freeport. And often it was a historic publication about Freeport. And there was never, ever one picture of any African-American in those publications.
When she asked why, she was told there weren't records of African-Americans living there, let alone pictures. So she began combing through the historical records herself, finding stories of centuries worth of black settlers in the county.
In order for history to be accurate, it must present an inclusive record of all people. Unfortunately, in the past, a substantial portion of the history of the Negro in Stevenson County has been omitted. This omission has allowed generations of the county's residents, both black and white, to grow up with a distorted view of Stevenson County and the roles African American have played in its development. And that's what I had to give to them, and they said, of course we'll publish your book. I place people of African descent in that time and place, in that space, where they should have been automatically put in that space.
Johnson says she's glad to see her books as more than just family history. She says they're textbooks people can learn from. As for herself, life has carried on through the years of research and hard work. She found her way into early childhood education and led Madison's Early Childhood Learning Center, taking in children who needed extra care. At 82, her work isn't done just yet. She still has another book to write and more history to share with the world.
Joyce Salter Johnson is the author of numerous historical books. WPR's Christine Hatfield brought you her story. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll find out how nonprofits here in Wisconsin have had to pivot during the pandemic to meet the changing needs of the people they help. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new series from Madison 365 is looking at a lot of different ways the pandemic has changed people's lives in Wisconsin. The series is called Lasting Impacts, and the first piece looks at nonprofit groups that had to pivot from their normal operations. Robert Chappell is executive editor of 365 Media Foundation. His recent piece for Madison 365 is called A Cultural Shift. Nonprofits see lasting changes, some subtle, some seismic, coming out of the pandemic. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. How are you?
Well, good. Now, you talk to people in the nonprofit world in Madison, mm-hmm. Dade County, Greater Green Bay area, Appleton. What led you to want to explore how the pandemic had influenced these nonprofit groups?
Well, we kind of put the question out there last year. We did a series in cooperation with the Wausau Pilot and Herald, and we actually came on your show and talked about that, the lasting impacts of the pandemic on incarceration. And that was just such a fascinating thing that there are things that are being done differently now in the prison and jail system that could have been done differently all along, right? And they're just deciding to do things differently now because of the pandemic, and some of those changes will stick. And we thought that was just really fascinating. And we started thinking about what other systems, institutions, day-to-day life things are going to just be different now, cross your fingers that there will be a post-pandemic time eventually. But, you know, what is it about our daily lives is going to be different now that we're going to look back 5 years from now and say, oh, we did that differently now because of the pandemic. So we started to think about different, you know, different areas of life that we know will have been impacted. And we wanted to tackle nonprofits first because, you know, we are a nonprofit news outlet. We're very deeply involved with the nonprofit community here in Madison, as well as around the state. And we just saw really, really quickly how the nonprofit sector addressed the pandemic needs, the immediate needs of the pandemic very early on, back in like March and April of 2020. So I just thought we should check in with them and talk about, you know, in the last year and a half, almost 2 years now, how have things changed for you, and which of those changes are going to stick?
Yeah, what were some of the biggest changes with mm-hmm. the, for many, sudden pivot to a very different set of needs?
Well, the first most apparent one is that nonprofit organizations started to do things that they'd never done before using the infrastructure they have in place, right? A good nonprofit has a network of contacts in a community, has an infrastructure to deliver services, and some of them just had to pivot to deliver different services. Like you had Literacy Network, which normally does, you know, English language learning, and they are now, so they've got this pot of this group of people that they serve, and now they're giving them not only literacy skills, but gas cards and grocery store gift cards and things like that to help them get through that really difficult time. You have the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County suddenly becoming a mask distribution organization. And they've, you know, they're normally doing after school care, education support, and now they've distributed 2.5 million face masks. You know, it's just that they know how to deliver services. They're just delivering different services. But then you also had a whole other sector of nonprofits in like the arts, for example, who kind of shut down completely and took several months to sort of reflect and be introspective and think about how they're going to do things differently in the future. And we're actually going to explore that in a later piece in the series. We're just going to look specifically at arts and culture.
What are some of the things, obviously, well, hopefully a group won't have to give out masks forever. What kind of changes did you see in their operations that they think, yeah, this might be a model. Maybe we should have been doing this all along.
I think the biggest thing on the nonprofit side from that, and we'll talk about the funding side also, mm-hmm. there's some permanent changes on the funding side, I think. But the biggest thing on the nonprofit side is collaboration. You have up in Appleton, you had a group of nonprofits that got together early in the pandemic to form the Multicultural Communications Committee, which basically just understanding that people needed to be informed. People needed information, and there are pockets and smallish communities all over the state, but you know, Fox Valley as well, that maybe don't speak English as a first language, don't engage with mainstream media, maybe won't trust the county coming to them. So they figured out, how can we reach these constituencies? These are our people that we work with every day. How can we get this information to their hands? And then they did that, and they were successful doing that. And a year later, now there are vaccines available. So they pivoted from communication to creating vaccine pop-ups, right? And they're doing this as a collaboration of different groups. And what's happening now is all those groups are actually getting together to form a brand new group. There's a whole new nonprofit up there called the Multicultural Coalition Incorporated. They've applied for 501c3 status. In fact, they may have already gotten it by now. This is a few weeks ago now that they said that they had applied for it. They're doing some funding to hire staff, and they're going to continue to do that collaborative work to address other equity issues in literacy, in transportation, in employment, and education disparities. So, and the collaboration part was really key for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's this, anybody in the nonprofit world knows, like you end up competing for money, right? There's government grants, there's foundation grants, and you're kind of fighting over scraps. But if you come together, you can all have a piece of the pie and you can all do your work by sharing resources. But also they were able to bring the really important issues of those marginalized communities to greater attention. Like they were getting meetings with the governor. They were getting meetings with the DHS secretary that an individual organization may not have been able to get that attention, but coming together, they're able to like raise the issues up and get more attention and more state resources as well.
You mentioned changes also in the way these things are funded and way fundraising mm-hmm. is done. Can you spend a minute or so talking about that?
Sure. Yeah. On the foundation side, I talk with the Greater Green Bay Community Foundation, and this is also reflected in my conversations with the Madison Community Foundation as well. But that funding just got more flexible, right? They've been talking for years about trying to make it easier for nonprofits to access funding. So in Green Bay, they were able to take their normal like 15-page grant applications, get it down to one page, just for expeditious purposes. And now they're finding out, oh, wait, we actually didn't really need those other 14 pages, right? They're meeting more frequently to get funding decisions made more quickly, and we could continue to do this. And also on the reporting side, you know, if you get a grant for $10,000, you spend the $10,000, then you got to write a 20-page report about what you did with the $10,000. They're getting rid of that, and they're just having a phone conversation. But how did it go? Were we able to meet your needs? What other needs do you have? And that's a much more interactive and much more just a much more productive way to look at what else needs to happen.
And you also wrote about in-person fundraising, that big annual event or whatever. Yeah. People can do that in person. Are those maybe going to go away?
Maybe. I think, you know, they're finding out maybe you don't need to do a silent auction for everything. Maybe it's that people actually want to give you money to support your cause, not to dress up and be fancy. So those fundraisers events, you know, might continue to be fun and stuff, but they're seeming less absolutely necessary.
Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
All right. Thanks for having me, Rob. I appreciate it.
Talking to Robert Chappell, Executive Director of 365 Media Foundation. We talked to him about his recent piece for the Madison 365 year-long series called Lasting Impacts, looking at the pandemic and its impacts on nonprofit organizations. If you have a story to share, if you work with a nonprofit, if you run one, if you receive services for one, what kind of things changed for you during the pandemic? Did you learn lessons maybe that will stick around after the pandemic? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, why do we accumulate so much stuff over the course of our lives? We'll sort things out with the author of a new book called Clutter, An Untidy History. And we'll ask you to share your stories and thoughts along the way. And Wisconsin has an unexpected budget surplus, but it's not clear what the state is going to do with it. We'll check out the options and the debates, and you could share your ideas and suggestions. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, last year saw a record number of enrollments in the Affordable Care Act marketplace. We'll find out why and check out the impact of the health care law. First, thousands of people who aided the U.S. in Afghanistan suddenly left their lives behind last August when the Taliban seized control of the country's capital and the American military evacuated their allies. Those evacuees are finally arriving at their new homes in Wisconsin and across the country in recent months. As Hope Kerwin reports, in collaboration with PBS Wisconsin, some Afghans say they're preparing to navigate the culture shock and potential immigration barriers they'll face as they start their new lives.
Shir Khan, his wife, and three children arrived at Fort McCoy in western Wisconsin in September. At first, their days were filled with immigration paperwork and getting used to their new surroundings. But waiting for their resettlement placement in Massachusetts became harder as winter weather forced them inside and left them with little to do. Before finally leaving for their new home in mid-January, Khan said they were most looking forward to having privacy again after living in a communal barracks with several other families.
People from different backgrounds came here. Like sometimes it is noisy inside. Sometimes we don't get along well.
Khan is a journalist. In Kabul, he worked for a company that implemented U.S.-funded projects. Khan said he had no plans to leave his home country before Kabul fell to the Taliban last August. His work made him a target of the armed Islamist group. And he wanted his children to get a better education than what would be possible under Taliban rule. But leaving their life behind hasn't been easy.
I was part of the middle class because I had job, I had house, I had family and friends, relatives, and connections with the people who were somehow in power. But when we came here, like, we lost control of almost everything.
Khan said he's grateful that he and his family survived and are now safe, but he knows adjusting to life in America will be difficult at first. He hopes his new neighbors will be understanding.
I might speak English. That's understandable, but that doesn't necessarily mean I know every single thing about the culture. That's why some people, including me, might behave strangely.
This culture shock is something Matula Mate and his family are navigating 1 month after arriving at their new home in Wausau. Mate says there are a lot of new systems to learn, like American traffic signals.
if the traffic light be the red, they might be crossing and thinking this is the walkway.
Matei is a tribal leader from southern Afghanistan. He worked for the U.S. Marines for 5 years, helping to recruit local workers for infrastructure projects. Matei says those military connections are what helped him escape with his wife and 6 children shortly after the Taliban's takeover. After months of staying on a military base in Virginia, they now live in a small 2-story home within walking distance of a bus stop and grocery store. Matei says his family has gotten a warm welcome in Wausau, and he's enjoyed getting to know his new neighbors, sometimes hosting them in his home over milk tea.
We are Afghans, like having more guests.
Matei says he's working on plans to start his own business, but his biggest worry is that his application for a special immigration visa, often called an SIV, hasn't been approved yet.
That is not only difficult for me or problem for me, that is the problem for all Afghans, especially for those people whom can't speak English.
He imagines for non-English speakers, the process can feel like fumbling in the dark. Because of their work for the U.S., Matei and Shirhan are able to apply for an SIV. Other Afghans are eligible for special priority in the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program because of their work or identity. But Madison-based immigration attorney Grant Sovereign says everyone else will have to quickly apply for asylum once they reach their new address. And he agrees with Matei that many would struggle to navigate the process on their own.
It is inherently difficult for somebody who doesn't speak the language, has just come from a traumatic situation, which is basically anyone applying for asylum, and not having the means to get that kind of help.
Sovereign says Congress could create an easier path to residency for evacuees, but he thinks that's unlikely given the controversy around immigration. Matei says he's still hopeful that policymakers will take action to help Afghans like him. He says residency would allow him to travel one day and offer him security about his future in the U.S. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hope Kerwin joins us now for more. Hope, welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here.
And Marissa Wojcik is series producer for Here and Now on PBS Wisconsin. She's been reporting on this story as well. You can find links to both of their reporting at WPR.org/Central Time. Marissa, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here as well.
Hope, let's start with you. We just heard some of the conversations you had with evacuees. One thing that stuck out is that Fort McCoy here in Wisconsin is just one step of many that these families have taken. What kind of things did people tell you about what the journey from Afghanistan to Wisconsin has been like?
Right. There were many steps in their journey, even before they made it to military bases like Fort McCoy. For many people, even just making it to the airport in the capital city of Kabul was a harrowing journey in and of itself. But after they left Afghanistan, they went to most folks went to a military base in another country, often Germany or Qatar, where they received immigration screening. From there, they traveled to the U.S. and eventually made their way to one of 8 military bases, including Fort McCoy. There, they went through more immigration processing and then simply had to wait for one of the U.S.'s resettlement agencies here in the U.S. to find a new community for them to settle in. And so I definitely heard from both of the people that I talked to that waiting process was at times difficult. Both people expressed a lot of gratitude for being able to come to the U.S., for being able to leave their situation in Afghanistan that put them at risk. However, you know, leaving a stable life where you have your own home and a routine and, you know, neighbors, connections, and transitioning to living in a communal barracks, often with several other families who you don't know, who are maybe from different backgrounds or used to different ways of living. There's definitely a lot of change there. I mean, I spoke with one person who talked about, you know, just a sheet being able to, you know, separate his family with 3 small children from other families and trying to navigate if someone wants to listen to music, but someone wants to read a book. How do you navigate those differences?
And Marissa, you've also been reporting on this. You focused, among other things, on the legal system that refugees have to navigate. What kind of things did you hear were big challenges or even roadblocks for people?
Yeah, so as you know, this happened very, very quickly, and a lot of things had to be figured out for this massive scale of people in a very short amount of time. And no matter what, the United States legal system and the immigration system is the immigration system. So people who came from Afghanistan, at first it was expected that most people were going to be coming on special immigrant visas, which are given out when people have been working with the United States. However, again, because this happened so quickly, that process can take up to 3 years in certain cases. And so people either were somewhere in the midst of that process or they hadn't started it yet. And normally that happens when the person is not inside the United States already. So it was very confusing as to how to go about this. And then on top of that, you need to still have maintained the connection to whatever military personnel or United States company that you worked for and have all the documentation. So there's so many different steps. So because a lot of special immigrant visas were really just kind of not possible in the chaos of this evacuation, an attorney, an immigration attorney that I spoke with, estimated roughly 50 to 60% of Afghan refugees who have come to the United States are under what's called this temporary parole status. And this specific parole status was for these Afghan refugees and it lasts 2 years. And very, very specifically, because immigration is not simple, it's parole status for humanitarian purposes. And even immigration attorneys were getting confused because on the flip side, there's something completely different called humanitarian parole, but it's not the same thing. And so now people have to start applying for asylum if they are under this temporary parole status. And the asylum process, again, within the U.S. immigration system is very complicated. And if people don't get that process started and finished within 2 years, there is potential that they could be deported and taken back to Afghanistan. And there's very limited legal services. So there's concern right now that immigration attorneys, especially working pro bono, will be able to handle the cases in front of them.
And Hope, it sounds like there's a lot of uncertainty. Legal, as Marissa was just talking about, issues about what job people will have, where they're going to live. Do you, in talking to a couple of the evacuees there, do you get a sense of kind of a hunger to at least get something stable going and start this whole new chapter in their lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think that both of the, you know, Afghan men that I spoke with, both, you know, had already been thinking about what they hoped their life would look like here in the U.S., right? I mean, this is kind of the situation that they've been thrust into. And so they are just thinking about, you know, what they hope to do if they can return to, you know, working in their previous careers. I spoke to one man who is a journalist, as was heard in my feature. And, you know, he was thinking about, you know, how can he get back into journalism and start contributing, you know, contributing positively again. You know, he talked about being frustrated that he wasn't really making a difference or being able to do work that makes a difference when he was spending time on base. So I definitely think that was like a common theme that I heard of people eager to kind of start their lives here, but also being intimidated by that process, thinking about how different life in America is going to be for them. And kind of having to learn all new systems, like how to ride a bus or even things like when to cross the street as a pedestrian. You know, those are very different here in the U.S. than they were in Afghanistan. And so, you know, they both talked about it would, you know, Afghans like themselves are just going to need time to learn those things. And they're also going to need their new neighbors to be patient and even maybe generous with their time to reach out and help them.
And Marissa, as we wrap up, the coverage this week involved PBS, WPR, WisContext. What parts of this story are you keeping an eye on next for maybe potential reporting down the road?
Yeah, as people are seeking different services and especially legal immigration services, we're keeping in touch with the attorneys, the immigration attorneys that that gave us some information in this story. And basically, Understanding how that process is going for people and seeing if there are certain kind of bureaucratic holdups or anything like that that are preventing people from finding kind of safe legal asylum passages to the United States. That's probably the biggest thing that we are focusing on. And I'll say that at least in Madison, it seems like the Afghan folks that are resettling in the area are connecting and helping one another and translating and finding cultural orientation. And so there might be some reporting in that area as well.
We'll leave it there. Marissa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Hope, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Hope Kerwin is a WPR reporter based in La Crosse. Marissa Wojcik is the assistant news director for PBS Wisconsin. They talked with us today about the reporting on the resettlement process for Afghan refugees. You can find a link to their stories at WPR.org/Central Time. In just a minute, we'll talk with the head of Wisconsin Resettlement Agency based in the Fox Valley, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the process of getting settled in a new home, how it works for these evacuees from Afghanistan? Have you been involved in this process? Have you volunteered helping out with this kind of work before? Is the refugee system part of your family's story? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about where the resettlement process stands for people who fled Taliban rule in Afghanistan last August. Some of them ended up at Fort McCoy in Wisconsin and are now finding homes here in the state and around the country. Tammy McLaughlin joins us now, Office Director for World Relief Fox Valley in Appleton. Tammy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. It's always great to be with you.
Can you talk a bit about what it's been like, what kind of things your group has been doing since those first families from Afghanistan arrived in the Fox Valley, I think back in November?
Yeah, so we've been welcoming Afghan newcomers. What that means is securing housing, furnishing that housing. We meet them at the airport. If they come from Fort McCoy, they're driven here. So we meet them either at their new home or some are staying in hotels until we find permanent housing. We're enrolling people in schools and benefits and making medical appointments. We're just really, really, really busy. A lot of it is very task-based type items. And it's really just to help people land and stabilize well when they get here.
What kind of things are you hearing from evacuees about what they're hoping for here in Wisconsin?
Well, the first thing, warmer weather. And that truly has been one of the points in every conversation that we've had. This is a hard place to welcome people. We've had such a cold snap. But we assure people that our spring and summer and falls are much, much more beautiful. But they, you know, seriously, and truly, again, that is a concern for some of the people. But just really want to start settling. You know they have to start over. They've left so much behind, and that includes not only family and friends, but possessions and homes and educations and careers, and just really have to start over. So they're ready and willing to get started as soon as possible.
As we heard from our reporters there, part of the story is the culture shock, moving from Afghanistan to Wisconsin very quickly. Things like crossing the street even are open questions. What are some of the little things that you're finding are common themes or questions from people from Afghanistan?
Those same types of things. I think we hear more of the bigger issues about a family. My family's still there. Do you think, we'd be able to be reunited? What about the immigration process, which you've recently discussed, just minutes ago? So those types of things are still those big, big things that they're concerned about. So we try and just, give them a sense of peace. Hey, let's focus on this right now. Let's focus on what's set before you. Let's get your kids enrolled in school. Let's get you enrolled in English classes, because that's also something very important to them. They want to learn, and they want to learn English, and they want their kids to be educated here. So although it's a high level, like big worry, we just try and say, hey, let's take it day by day and do the simple things and you'll start seeing progress.
Talking to Tammy McLaughlin with World Relief Fox Valley in Appleton, looking at the resettlement process for Afghan evacuees, settling some of them in the Appleton area. Tammy, what kind of response have you gotten from local volunteers and community groups?
Incredible response. We are so pleased and so thrilled at the response of the community. We have a model called Good Neighbor Teams, which is a church that walks the churches, small groups that walk alongside refugee families. And they've been at the airport. We had one the other night at 10:45 there at the airport meeting, waiting to welcome their family. I mean, what better sense of, hey, I'm welcomed here, I'm wanted here and received here than to have new friends meeting you at the airport. You know, we've had volunteers help with grocery shopping, simple things like haircuts, some pretty big things like taking people to medical appointments. We have a family who has two children who need to go to Green Bay twice a week for medical treatments. I mean, it's a huge scale, small scale, and everything in between. And we couldn't do this work that we're doing without the support and partnership of community partners as well as volunteers that have really stepped into this resettlement effort.
Is there any kind of particular need right now of kinds of donations or particular volunteer needs or anything else that you're looking at right now?
We'll just continue to, onboard volunteers. We take that very seriously. We want to train people well, help them understand culture, help them understand the Afghan experience, those types of things. And then we will continue to pair people as much as we can because we know that extra support and enhancement of what we're trying to teach, you know, if partners are walking alongside, reiterating that and practicing, that just makes for a better experience and more, a deeper resettlement and deeper roots when you have that community reinforcement. So we're just going to continue to onboard volunteers as many as we can and continue to pair up as much as we can. We think that's really critical, not only short-term, but long-term too. You know, some things take longer to get a sense of. So we know that this is not a short-term effort. It's not a 30, 60, 90 day. We want to continue to walk alongside our newcomers as long as we can.
You joined us over the past few years and talked about a big drop in the number of refugees under Trump administration rules. Now here's a big group coming all at once. Was it kind of going from zero to 60 for you real quick?
What do they say? You're building the plane as you're flying it. Yeah, it's been a heavy lift because it's, you know, we have a mass amount of people coming and we're trying to rebuild our staff, from the past several years. So, again, couldn't have done this effort without volunteers. We also know this has been difficult for partners because they also haven't been staffed up. But one of the benefits in the Fox Valley is we are resettling in Menasha and Appleton and Oshkosh. So we have partners in all three of those locations. So that has spread, you know, the volume in some respects. And I think that's made it a little easier on partners. But again, the volunteers have been incredibly amazing and beneficial and impactful in this resettlement initiative.
In just our last minute, is there anything about either the evacuees you've worked with or the resettlement process that you think gets left out of the conversation or the media coverage you've seen?
Well, we've alluded to it, but, you know, the resettlement program, this program was designed by our Congress to be a public and private partnership, a collaborative effort amongst many sectors of a community. And I've been working in resettlement for 8 years. I have never seen that collaborative effort unfold like it has the past couple of months. It's been inspiring and encouraging just to see the community surround this, our newcomers like they have. And again, this is the way it was designed to be. So it's really, really been just a privilege to work in this environment in such a collaborative community. And I think all of our Wisconsin communities are equally as collaborative. Thank you.
Tammy, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Really appreciate your interest and all you do for us. Thank you.
That's Tammy McLaughlin, Office Director for World Relief Fox Valley, based in Appleton. She talked to us about her group's work in resettling evacuees from Afghanistan. Earlier, we talked to WPR reporter Hope Kerwin and Marissa Wojcik from PBS Wisconsin about their coverage of the issue. You can find their stories over at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, health insurance enrollment through the Affordable Care Act marketplaces increased over 20% last year. We'll find out what's driving the jump in the use of those marketplaces. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.